Welcome to Gold Star Classroom, the podcast where our panelists go back to school. We'll grade them on their answers to a variety of general knowledge and trivia questions. They don't know what we're going to ask, and we don't know what they're going to say. The student with the highest grade at the end of the class will win the coveted classroom prize, the Golden Banana. I'm your host and headmaster, Professor Jerry Jaffe. Welcome to today's episode of Gold Star Classroom. It's my pleasure to introduce today's students. On my left, the man, the myth, the legend, Travis Rice.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming to class today, Travis.
My pleasure being here, sir.
And on my right, the caffeinated voice of reason, Steve Sabo.
I'm happy to be here, too.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We have high expectations.
Oh, don't have too high expectations.
And sitting directly across from me in class is the cunning linguist and master debater, Jeff Gettert.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for coming to class today.
Thank you for having me.
In today's class, I'll be asking the students a series of general knowledge questions from all across the realm of knowledge, science, and information. And, as all teachers do, I'll be grading your answers. So stay on your toes and do your best. As the great wise philosopher of our time, Joey Tribbiani, once said, knowledge is a tricky thing. However, this talk of grades does raise its own conundrum, so I'll put it to you as your first quiz question. In the American letter grading system, why is there no E?
Wow, that's actually a good question. We all just sat there and went,
Thank you. The question gets an A, we've determined.
Right. Why is there no E?
Why is there no E?
Only thing I can think of off the top of my head, you could turn the F into an E. One thing could step up one letter grade. An easy way to
finish. That's probably a good answer.
A good guess.
I was trying to think of it like if E stood for anything. I think I'm going easy, or elementary, exactly. I mean, I don't think so. I think that's probably better. It's easier to fake. All the other letters are pretty.
Although I will say, Steve, your guessing and grasping does have some merit as well. It's more of an urban legend than a fact, but it has been suggested that some teachers are worried that E could stand for excellent.
Ah, yeah.
That's sort of an unconfirmed urban legend, but that is something you'll probably come across if you try to look into this question.
Interesting.
My brain automatically looks like a delinquent.
Jeff, what do you think?
I think that when they decided they wanted to have a grading system for students or for results, they said, okay, let's make it five levels, and then the bottom one is fail. And that if we go A, B, C, D, E is fine, but oh, it's just so close to F, and F is so conveniently for fail, we're going to bump that down one.
Your answer is the closest to the truth so far. But so let me ask you this. When did we start using letter grades? I can assure you that in the past, like in the old Greek schools of Aristotle or the old German schools of Kant, they did not use letter grades.
Well, did they also have different languages so those letters would be completely different?
You're not wrong there.
Well, it's going to be like pi.
XXL.
Right, exactly.
You wouldn't know if it was
just a grade or a movie year.
Right. It's a Super Bowl. What is it? A Super Bowl.
Plus 5 points for interculturalism.
Oh, very nice.
I'm going to guess that the standard is...
When was the modern letter grading system first invented or introduced?
In America or the world?
Oh, that's also a good question.
That is a good question, and I will say the statistic I have is for America, though it may be that it was invented in the United States, but I can't confirm
that. I'm trying to remember back on Little House on the Prairie.
That documentary on Prairie.
That's as far back as I can remember grades being assessed.
Only if I had John Boy on speed dial.
Now, there's no phone a fictional friend here.
I don't know.
Standardization of the American school system would have been like post-Civil War.
Sure.
I would think pre-1900s would be my guess. But maybe late 1890?
Mount Holyoke College has the earliest record of a letter grade system, and that was in 1897.
Oh,
nice.
Oh, not bad.
Very good.
Not bad.
There is some evidence of letters being used.
Why did they get no points for that? That was pretty close. That's been 7 years. That's really good.
We'll call that a hand grenade A. It exploded in the right direction of the answer. The answer. There were some references that people aren't sure what it means to letter grades in the 1880s. But a full-fledged, like A through F,
mm-hmm.
letter grade system, Mount Holyoke, 1897. And to back up something that Mr. Gettert had guessed at, it actually did go A through E.
Aha!
They had five increments.
Mm.
The actual scale itself was very irregular.
But none of them knew how to spell fail.
But why did they get rid of the E? That's the question.
Why did they get rid of the E? That is the question. The original 1897 Mount Holyoke grading system, only 95 on up was an A.
Mm.
B and C each had 10-point ranges. And a precise 75 was a D.
Wow.
And anything less than 75 was a dreaded E.
Exactly 75%.
Yes. There's only 1% that constituted a D.
That is the weirdest system ever. Like, 95 and above, I kind of get, you know, that's like, that's, you know, but, so it would go, a B would be like 85 to 95?
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. That would suck, though.
One dot on
94
for
a D.
Yeah.
And then over the next couple of years, Mount Holyoke added F as the failing grade and kept tweaking the math on these grade ranges. And then other schools started incorporating similar letter-based systems.
So what was below the D before the F?
Mount Holyoke did have an E to represent failure for a very brief time, maybe even only 1 or 2 years. And as other schools adopted this letter grading system, like the math was still irregular. So at different colleges.
Mount Holyoke College?
Yes.
So the grading system started in college.
Yes.
Which is interesting because we don't do that anymore. Now we have a number system for college.
Well, it might depend on the college that you go to, but I would say the majority of colleges still use A through F, although they may have a plus and minus.
Well, I always went to, like, you know, you get 4 point, 3 point, 3.2, 3.8.
Yes, that is to calculate your grade point average. But your grade in class.
The GPA versus the grade.
Yes, like your grade in your biology class, or your grade will still be like an A minus, a C minus.
But there's still a corresponding letter, even with the point average or whatever. It's
like
3.4 and up is an A or something.
The majority, I certainly would never say 100%, of the majority of colleges in America today, when the students get their transcript, it will say A, B, C, D, F grades on the transcript.
I don't remember that. But
And then somewhere it will say, probably at the top, GPA.
Yeah.
And that will say 3 points on.
That's all I worried about when I was in college. That was it.
Right. Well,
that
you probably should be worried about it, I would say, based
right.
on your work so far.
Sounded like an insult. I'm not sure. I thought I was doing pretty good on this one.
Oh, well, minus 5 points for not knowing that was an insult.
Oh.
Wow.
Brutal.
By the 1930s, the letter grading system across the country had been regularized.
Standardized. I get a point for that?
Plus 1 point for knowing standardized is a synonym for regularized.
Is regularized actually a word?
It is now.
Wow. Well, I was going to say I should get points for knowing it's not a word. It doesn't sound like a real word.
Well, the great Edwin Hubble, discoverer of galaxies, once said, "Equipped with his five senses, man explores the universe around him and calls the adventure science." And like Edwin Hubble discovering galaxies, I would probably need a telescope to calculate this class's grade so far, the numbers being so small and so far away.
We're just warming up.
Or a microscope.
Yale has the world's most powerful electron microscope.
Hmm.
Perhaps if we could get access to that, we could get a close look at this class's grade so far. However, in an effort to improve your grades, we're going to turn our attention to an interesting historical monument. In Sarasota, which is where there was a famous American Revolutionary battle, there is a famous war monument. That war monument depicts a statue of a boot. And I'm going to read this because it's a very interesting inscription. "In memory of the most brilliant soldier of the Continental Army who was desperately wounded on the spot, winning for his countrymen the decisive battle of the American Revolution and for himself the rank of Major General." However, this mysterious monument does not was the name of this glorious soldier. Who is this mystery man from the American Revolution? Who led one of the most decisive battles, yet goes unnamed on the main monument commemorating it?
Okay.
Guesses or answers?
Shoeless Joe Jackson.
Shoeless Joe Jackson, another American hero.
The Unknown Soldier.
The Boot of the Unknown Soldier.
Oh.
Could be. Could be.
I've got nothing right now. I'm trying to go Sarasota. I'm going, was he born in Sarasota? Was he somebody
individual has many odd monuments to him around the United States. I'm just going to tell you about one more to see if that's a clue.
The guy that invented Monopoly.
And for the win, his name is?
Milton Bradley?
No.
Damn.
On the grounds of the United States Military Academy at West Point, and West Point is also a fortification as well as a military academy, they have plaques commemorating all of the generals of the Revolutionary War.
Uh-huh.
But one plaque bears only a rank and date, Major General born 1740, but no name. And it is referring to the same person from the Boot Monument.
Hmm.
So does this guy have a name?
A fair question. And the answer to that is yes. Not only does he have a name, he has a very famous name that I'm sure all of my students know as soon as we connect the dots.
Well,
why would they not have put the name on there if he has one?
He has a name, and there is a reason.
It's an extremely long name.
John Jacob.
It's like Slavic name with a whole bunch of consonants and no vowels.
It can't be as simple as George Washington or something, right?
It's not as simple as George Washington, although this person was a comrade and good friend of George Washington. Probably the second most important general after George Washington to the Revolutionary War effort.
Let's see. I don't know that many generals.
I don't know that
General
many
Burnside, the guy that did sideburns.
I just know the Founding Fathers, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin.
Travis.
General Disarray.
General Disarray.
Oh.
General Specific. General Payne. All famous generals.
General Mills. Bitter Cereal.
This commander was instrumental in victory in Boston, which was the first major victory for the revolutionaries.
Reed's Hill. But the hill in Boston, it's a famous hill, is not the actual hill, it's Breed's Hill.
Bunker Hill is where the monument is.
The battle
took place at Breed's Hill, that's correct.
Hmm.
But to win that battle, they needed cannons. And this commander raided some British forts in Canada and brought their cannons to Boston. He also led America, meaning sort of the country of America's, first naval battle. He was in charge of a small fleet on some lakes in the New York area. And it was actually a tactical retreat because the British Navy was like the armada of the day. So it was a retreat, but it was a brilliant tactical retreat that is studied by sort of naval and military historians.
I bet if there was a non-U.S. citizen here, they'd know the answer.
Right.
Do you have
initials? Can we go with initials?
A rank or something?
Well, he was a general.
Oh, you said that.
He was, by the end of his career, he was the second highest ranked general after George Washington. I will give you one clue. This is like, in my mind, the clue which lets the cat out of the bag. If you were so disgusted with someone, a friend or a politician, because they betrayed you, what name would you call him?
Benedict Arnold.
Point goes to Jeff Gettert. In fact, I think you deserve a gold star for that.
Nice.
Yes, the first gold star.
So they removed his name because he was a traitor.
Because he was a traitor.
Oh.
Correct.
Interesting.
So, I mean, the war monument from Sarasota came generations later, and a historian, military historian who was funding it, felt that Benedict Arnold's contribution, which was basically essential to the success of that battle, had to be included, but did not want to name his name.
Go to all the trouble of building these monuments around the country to the guy, but we can't say who he is.
Correct. You have to realize in the 1800s especially, saying Benedict Arnold was like saying Voldemort.
Oh, yeah.
It was the name you didn't mention.
But it makes sense in a sense, because I was actually reading something about how... It's a long story short. I mean, your you're remembered more for your failures than your
right.
successes.
Yes.
You can have a million successes and be remembered by one failure.
Right.
And they're talking about how General Custer was supposedly like the most brilliant general during the
yeah.
Civil War.
Right.
And everybody remembers him, you know, getting his ass kicked by the Indians.
Right.
So, but there's monuments to him everywhere about how
right.
great of a warrior he was. You're like, oh, really? Because
right.
didn't he just really get destroyed?
Well, he lost his last battle.
Yeah.
And General Custer probably lost that battle because there were some other cavalry troops that didn't support him.
Yeah.
So when he went into the combat, he thought he had more troops. Even though he didn't know he was about to be ambushed, he still thought he had more support.
Mm-hmm.
And like half of the regiment was under a different commander and didn't come in to back him up.
Right.
And it was his last battle. I mean, had he lived to fight another battle,
that would just be another battle.
Died of old age or something.
That's true.
Yeah.
So whatever taste you leave in their mouth.
Now,
yeah.
Speaking of remembering one's final or bad deeds, what actually did Benedict Arnold do? What was his treason?
Mm.
Well, I'll have Steve the engineer adding cricket noises to that long pause.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's gonna be a few of those.
He was a traitor.
He was a traitor.
Was it at the? Was it
a,
during the war?
It was still during the war.
Revolutionary
yes.
war. To like, so that would be to the French or to the British?
To the British.
He had to have given up some important information to the British
right.
soldiers.
Yes. Yes, he did.
We're not going to wear the red coats. We're going with the other ones. You can have the red.
Yes. The fashion sense. Keeping in mind that there would be no telephones, internet, that sort of thing, everything had to be done clandestine and by letter, so it took months for things to unfold.
Mm.
So it actually took, I would say, over a year for his treasonous activities to unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had to earn the trust of the British officers he was trying to turn to.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a period of letter writing where he would give up information, particularly about troop movements.
Mm.
As like an act of trust. But there was an actual very specific sabotage that he planned and proposed to the British that was uncovered before it could occur.
Is this about the NSA wiretap?
Not yet, it's not, but we'll get there eventually. He hatched a plot to turn over West Point to the British.
Oh, really?
Yes. Wow. And so he was carefully sending letters with the suggestions and dates, and they were sending them back, and they were making demands of him, like, there has to be at least 3,000 troops present to make it worth our while. And
wow. And was he executed?
He escaped
mm.
to England. One of the couriers, one of the British spies that was carrying his letters back and forth, was caught, and he had letters on him from Benedict Arnold,
mm-hmm.
and when Benedict Arnold found out that guy had been caught, he, like, fled within 24 hours. So, in fact,
gotcha.
He also, for the last couple of years of the Revolutionary War, actively fought for the British.
Oh.
Like, the British gave him the rank of, I want to say Brigadier General, but some general rank.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped from behind the lines with the British military operations.
He's a complete turncoat.
Complete turncoat.
Until after the war, where he came up with the recipe for some eggs.
Some eggs.
Yeah.
The rest is history.
Although no Revolutionary War menu mentions those eggs by name.
Right, right. Just a big blank in eggs.
He spent the last 10 or 12 years of his life in England and a little bit in Canada.
Hmm.
And, when he converted, when he started his turncoat activities, he was considered such a patriot that the British captain in charge of espionage was drawing up a list of generals that he was going to try to convert. And on that list was not Benedict Arnold's name. And then suddenly he got a letter from Benedict Arnold suggesting that he himself would turn. And that captain was so incredulous at first because of Benedict Arnold's reputation as like the ultimate patriot. So let's ask at least one more question about Benedict Arnold. What caused him to change sides?
It's got to be a woman, right?
He's power hungry.
That's a good guess.
War
really.
And power always comes down to that woman.
He was married, and he and his wife were considered very close, but she was not part of the turncoat plan in any way.
No mistress in there?
No mistress in there.
No
that is no, no that none has been recorded by history.
A Those powdered wigs were amazing.
Yes.
Because he got turned down for a promotion, and George Washington got the promotion.
You are half right. I would almost want to give you a gold star for that, but I'm holding back.
Give me a silver star.
Oh, all right. One silver star and a smiley face.
A great job sticker.
The Continental Congress had a lot of conflict in it, just like our Congress does now.
Mm-hmm.
And Benedict Arnold had supporters and detractors. And the detractors had more voice in the Continental Congress than his supporters did. And he kept getting blocked by Congress, including promotions.
Mm-hmm.
And as a wealthy man himself, he would often fund his own troops. Like if they needed more food, he would just go out and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
If they needed more supplies, his troops loved him. He was also a frontline general. Whenever battles, he was standing right with the troops fighting.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So his own troops tended to love him.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesser officers, like captain and lieutenants who worked with him, tended to love him. But in the Continental Congress, he was a controversial figure. And he kept not only getting his promotions blocked, which George Washington was one of his biggest supporters.
Mm.
So there were some other officers who were blocking his promotions, but not George Washington.
Mm.
But the second thing is, because he spent a lot of his own money on his troops, he kept turning in receipts. Which was common military practice because of militias and standing armies and things. And Congress kept not reimbursing him.
Okay, run off and defend the country for us and get the receipts.
And then we're not going to honor them after you've turned them in because of paperwork problems.
Do you guys validate? Can we?
Can you validate this war receipt for me? That was the kind of thing he was not getting reimbursed because the paperwork wasn't right.
Hmm.
In fact, when he finally turned, he got paid in the vicinity of 6,000 British pounds. I'm not exactly sure what that converts to, but hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
But he was owed by the Continental Congress over 20,000 British pounds.
Wow.
So to say that he turned for money was one of the things that was said about him.
Right.
But
his own money.
Not the case. Yes, in fact, his own money.
Well, he sounds like a great guy. It sounds like the Continental Congress were jerks.
Yes, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Picture that.
Well, he's an interesting figure. And for expressing interest in Benedict Arnold, you get an A. Travis, however, I'm worried about your grade. You're going to need to do some work on this next topic.
What do we got here?
Jeff, you have exactly a 75, which
Yay.
Is in Mount Holyoke, and 87 would be a B. Jeff, I know you're a musician and an artist. Let's turn to art and culture. This is a statistic from 1954, so you got to think about America in the 50s. It has been estimated that one half of all art hanging in American living rooms in 1954 was of this type of art?
Type of picture?
Abstract expressionism.
It was not abstract expressionism. However, that figures into our story later. So I'm glad you brought it up, but we'll have to come back to it.
Cubism.
No. Travis?
Religious.
Interesting.
Ooh.
But not
Good
the
answer.
Answer we're looking for. You get an A for effort, but an F for correctness.
You got to go straight to the religion.
F for incorrectness.
I was going to say portraits, you know, like family portraits, that kind of thing.
The art in question is realistic, as portraits are, realistic style art, but there's a very particular type.
Norman Rockwell?
Well, not Norman Rockwell, not to that high of like that 50% mark.
Like,
I'm sure it was very common as well.
Portraits as opposed to landscapes?
Well, portrait or landscape, or even religious,
realism
would be subject matter.
Okay.
But this is actually an art-making process.
Oh.
Oil paintings.
Velvet
Elvis.
That would be 1974.
Macrame. It's macrame.
All right, students, put on your seatbelts, your helmets, and your goggles, because you're going to fall out of your chairs when you hear the answer to this question. If this estimate is correct, in 1954, over half the art hanging in American living rooms was paint by number.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, where's Bob Ross when you need him?
Paint by number.
Like, were numbers just invented in the 50s? And like, oh, we can use these to paint.
No, but you know what was invented in the 50s?
The grade system.
That was mass-produced number picture things?
Paint by number kits were invented in 1951,
Oh.
By Palmer Painting Supplies.
Yeah, but then why would they hang them on their walls? Because those were like...
Because they were...
What else are you going to do with it once you've got it done?
It's considered like hobby art. People would buy the kits, paint them. And this was like adults. This wasn't coloring books for children. This was an adult hobby.
Yeah.
So you've painted your landscape or your religious art or your animal. Actually, historic vistas views were also popular to paint by number subjects.
Okay, I have a question.
And then hang that on the wall.
What medium did they use? These were not watercolors. These were likely oil-based
yes.
paints. And I'll point out that I previously answered oil.
Well, they could have been acrylics and other things as well.
The Gold Star Classroom does not reward rules lawyers.
All right. Huh. That is interesting. I would have never guessed that.
The paint by numbers was invented. It was invented by an artist called Dan Robbins, plus a man called Max Klein, and Max Klein worked for Palmer Paint Supplies.
Hmm.
So the two of them developed this technique, these art kits.
And they included the paints and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
It's a way to sell more paint.
Now, keeping in mind that Dan Robbins was an artist, he, in fact, initially designed abstract art kits, but they were not popular with the American consuming public.
So the first thing he invented was abstract.
Well, I don't know if it was first, but in the early versions of paint-by-number kits you could buy at stores included abstract as an option,
gotcha.
But they didn't sell. The representational, realistic style paintings.
You couldn't get like a Jackson Pollock kit.
Paint-by-number Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, exactly.
Outstanding. One number, one instructions last year.
Right.
Although, paint-by-number kits are still available. You could go to any art store, probably, and buy some. Possibly some children's stores, like toy stores. They're not the hobby that they were in the 50s. However, they are, in a kitschy sort of way, part of art history. The Smithsonian Museum of American History has archives on paint-by-number kits and inventions. And, for example, there's a long list of this if you're interested. I'm just going to give you one example. In 2011, the Museum of Modern Art in New York accepted some paint-by-number designs by Max Klein.
Hmm.
So, like, significant museums do paint-by-number displays and shows and things.
Well, he would have had to have, you know, at least drawn the original outlines for those paintings, right?
You know, in the mass-produced versions, of which there were hundreds and hundreds of subjects, I'm not sure who would have produced. I'm imagining a factory is involved somewhere. You know, they're pressed somehow.
Hmm.
But where the original designs came from would have been Palmer Paint Supplies.
I'm just thinking if he embedded it and he drew the original sketches, then he should get some recognition.
Yeah.
For that
in fact, that is what the Museum of Modern Art displayed were some of his early designs.
Hmm.
So whether that was hand-drawn or how it was manufactured, I don't know. But you
mass-produced the same picture over and over. Andy Warhol looks at it and goes, I got an idea.
Yes. Andy Warhol did do paint-by-number sort of parodies as well. That was part of his portfolio, inspired by paint-by-numbers. All right, class. I'm going to give you one more chance to improve your grade. So I'm expecting high things out of you. This is the realm of science and biology. And I'm just going to ask you a very simple question, and we'll see what kind of answers you have. The question is this. Why do we itch?
Hope it wasn't last night.
That's why you itch, Travis. I don't think it's why I itch.
Why do we itch?
Why do human animals itch?
It's got to be a nerve thing, right?
Related to nerves, nerve endings, nerve reactions.
Yeah.
Reaction to a foreign body?
To shed skin?
To shed skin? Possibility? Since I've said the question, why do we itch? Everyone in this class has scratched themselves at least once.
Is that true? I think my mouth's more of a rub.
Well, I can't see what your hands are doing below the table.
No, that's true.
I mean,
I don't know, it's skin. Your skin's reacting. There's nerves, like your skin senses something. So it's an offshoot of the desire to react to something as a defensive mechanism.
I mean, on the one hand, itching is related to other similar sensations.
Well, I mean, itching is different than scratching. No, but yes. Realistic, itching is the feeling that you need to scratch. And we scratch to take care of the itch.
Okay.
So,
as one biology book put it, itch creates a scratch reflex. Gold
right.
Star Steve Sabo.
Nice.
So there you go.
Nice. So your question was not about scratching, it was about itching.
Well, the initial question used the word itch, but it opened the doorway to discussing itching, scratching.
And any number of rashes.
And any number of rashes. And Travis's lady friend from last night.
Nice. We all make mistakes.
It's an odd thing to study because it's like itching and scratching are a little bit conceptual. It's like how we describe in words these sensations. Then you try to... Scientists try to study the sensation at the level of neurons and brains and what's going on, and it's not like there's a speech center for the brain or a visual cortex of the brain. There's not an itch center to the brain.
Right.
It's just one of sensations. So there's pain sensation, heat sensation, tickle sensation, and itch sensation, and they all trigger reflexes similar to the scratch reflex.
And those aren't local to any particular area of the brain?
I would be happy to have a proper neuroscientist correct me. So I don't want to stick my neck
far out. You're not in any danger of that at the moment.
Correct.
Not here.
So on the neural level, it's a sensation. So the difference between the different sensations is partially how we understand the sensation, not strictly speaking.
But it would be interesting if somebody had a brain injury and they never itched.
Yeah, exactly. That's what
correct.
I think. Yeah.
You can get rid of smell. You can get rid of sight just by just
like
parts of your brain.
You can lose the sensation of touch as well.
Yeah.
Like feeling can also be damaged or impaired by brain damages.
Sensitivity to heat or things
yes.
like that.
But would you if you lost that sensation? Would you still itch, but you wouldn't feel it if you scratched?
Also, even
eternal torture.
All right.
That
would be terrible.
It has been said that, reported by doctors anecdotally, that people sometimes lose the sensation that their bladder is full, but they still mentally know they have to go to the bathroom.
Interesting.
That can be a side effect of prostate cancer treatment.
Hmm.
Is that you lose the sensation of a full bladder, but mentally you just know. He's like, goes, oh, I have to go to the bathroom, and that occurs to you.
This is a side effect of the treatment, not the cancer.
Yes, but I'm not going to rule out that the cancer could have that effect, but it is reported during the side effect.
If I have to go to the bathroom, and then I don't have to go to the bathroom, but then I actually do have to go to the bathroom, I might have prostate cancer, is what you're saying. This is a horrific revelation.
To be clear, I'm in no way endorsing what you just said.
I'm just wondering,
everybody, ask your doctor.
Do you just try? Because I know I go to the bathroom because I have to go to the bathroom, because I know I have to go to the bathroom. Could I go to the bathroom if I didn't have to go to the bathroom?
You could, actually, because your bladder slowly fills up. And generally, when you get the sensation of, oh, I have to urinate, it's about when your bladder's a third full.
Oh, really?
So your bladder can be less than a third full. So I don't know if you've ever had the experience of going to the doctor and they hand you a cup and you say, I don't have to go to the bathroom. And they say, well, just try.
Right, right.
And then you do get a little bit of
You can do it.
I'm never going to go to the bathroom again and not debate on whether or not I have to go or if this is really, am I have to go or is this kind of have to go?
Well, if you start to feel like that urgent having to go, like when you're on a road trip and you're wondering when the next stop is, then you're probably over the 50% full, like if you're feeling actual discomfort.
Well, I've always thought it was weird that sometimes you really have to go, but if you still wait, it goes away.
Right.
There's some sensations like hunger that you're hungry and you feel it, but then if you wait a while, it kind of goes away, although you haven't actually eaten.
Again, neuroscience is complex, and I would welcome the correction of a proper neuroscientist, but I think, like itching, it's been drawn to your attention.
And
that's what needs to happen. It doesn't actually need to be monitored after that.
So it's like your brake pads. Like when you hear the squealing, that means it's time to change your brake pads. But if you keep driving on it, the squealing goes away.
Also, itching is irritable, but it's also pleasurable. And that in and of itself makes it a little troubling to study because it's not just like one thing.
Fine line between pleasure and pain.
Exactly, a fine line. Everyone likes a good massage, but some people like to have their back scratched as well their scalp scratched, that kind of thing. So there is a pleasure pain there. Tickling is even more troubling to study. What is tickling? What is causing it? What is happening? Although lots of animals scratch and itch, very few animals tickle. That might be a uniquely human
Are apes ticklish? Do we know that?
The apes have never been observed tickling one another.
Really? Has anybody ever been observed tickling an ape?
Not in live to tell about it.
Yes.
Right. How do you test that?
You made it out with that hand.
Interesting.
Itchiness can also be a chronic problem. It has been suggested that 4% of the global population have difficulty with chronic itchiness. That would be 280 million people globally.
That's a lot.
Have chronic
directly related to our soap.
Could be related to soap or not soap. Even the question of you can scratch yourself, but typically it is said that you can't tickle yourself. Can anyone here tickle themselves?
I've
never tried.
I'm sadly very ticklish, and I don't think I could.
For our listeners at home, Travis has a very strange smile on his face right now.
I'm sadly imagining myself tickle myself right now.
Even the great Greek philosopher Aristotle wondered why people cannot tickle themselves.
As a conundrum.
Not like with a feather or anything like that? You couldn't...
Well, again, we're entering the realm of sensations of your skin that you have a reflex to.
Right.
So, yeah, there are some things you can do, like if you used a ticklish device or maybe touched yourself in a certain way, you would feel it. But that kind of like tickling, like brothers and sisters attacking each other...
I imagine it's because if you do it to yourself, you know it's coming.
Right.
You anticipate it.
But other times, but if somebody starts tickling you, you still know it's coming. I mean,
but you don't know.
Stop.
Yeah, but you don't necessarily know exactly how it's going to feel.
Yeah, the exact spot and where. Yeah.
Now, I am known to some students to be a harsh grader. I'm going to calculate your final grades here in a moment. I fear that half of the class has failed, and since there are three of you, I need to check my calculator.
As I said, that's
harsh. You know who can change that? The teacher.
I really drug down the average.
There is one other person who can change it, and that's the student. So while I'm calculating your final grades and deciding who the winner of today's classroom prize, the golden banana, will be, I'd like to give each of you one more chance for extra credit, which will take the form of anything you'd like to say on your own behalf. Travis.
I really, really, really like that joke you said about teaching your wife English and her slang. That was one of the greatest jokes I've ever heard. On a side note.
Wow, that's really...
That's hardcore like, brown nosing.
Yeah, that's a...
I've been teaching for over...
Degree.
It was a rough class.
Wow.
I've been teaching for over 20 years, and that could be the most hardcore brown nosing I have ever seen.
Wow.
Jeff, anything you'd like to say or ask or make on your own...
I am not now, nor have I ever been a member of the Communist Party.
Minus 10 points.
Oh!
And Steve, extra credit for you.
I will say in all sincerity that I found this very interesting and informative, and I'm glad I was a part of it.
Oh, well, we thank you for being a part of it.
Semi-brown.
Yeah, that's like proper professional
brown
nosing.
That's truthful. That's truthful. I mean, it might seem like brown nosing, but I'm very interested by these answers.
For a moment, I thought the golden banana would go to Travis because he spoke the least and therefore said the least number of stupid things.
Uh-huh.
However... His over-the-top tsunami of brown nosing while crowning him. And there's. Jeff's repudiation of the Communist Party guarantees he does not deserve the golden banana. Though, ironically, were he a member of the Communist Party, he himself would not approve of one student being singled out for a golden banana prize. So it was a lose-lose situation. It was a lose-lose situation. Which brings us to today's class's top student... Mr. Steve Sabo,
winner
of the Golden Banana. And that just leaves it to me, your host, Dr. Jerry Jaffe, to thank you, my students, for coming to today's class.
Gold Star Classroom is written and produced by Jerry Jaffe. Our producer and engineer is Stephen Gutierrez. Original music composed and produced by Jeff Gettert. Mr. Gettert is also our assistant producer. All commentary and opinions expressed by guests of Gold Star Classroom are meant for entertainment purposes only. For Gold Star Classroom, I'm Jerry Jaffe.